Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Today we're going to be talking about so many interesting shrubs to choose from that, you know, there's so many, sometimes it's difficult to pick the right ones. And to help us out, we have Mark Dwyer with us. Back once again, he's Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. He'll answer your questions about shrubs and other gardening questions as well, certainly. So I hope you'll join in the conversation. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. You can find us on Facebook, at our Ideas Network page, and just join in that conversation. Mark Dwyer, welcome. Good to have you back.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
Before we talk about shrubs, let's talk about Rotary Gardens. Lots of shrubs in Rotary Gardens, but what's going on there? What's happening?
Well, we're seeing, Janesville spring has arrived not only on the calendar, but we're seeing some early blooms right on track. Things like snowdrops, winter aconite, Danford irises. These are all three fall-planted bulbs, in essence, that are extremely early blooming. And I think with a little more heat, we'll see a lot more activity with things popping out of the ground, and spring will be upon us.
Well, you always have beautiful specialty gardens. I've always enjoyed walking those gardens. What do you have planned for this year?
Ooh, lots of exciting things. This year, our big color scheme, about 40% of the gardens is different every year because of the seasonals we choose. Our big color scheme we're calling our pastel extravaganza. Lots of pastels. We're going to do a New Guinea impatiens display. Our pollinator garden will be back with an alphabetical theme. And we're doing this fun Plants of the World collection where we're showing plants from 13 different countries, native plants, their most common vegetables. And with education being our mission, these collections are geared towards not only being beautiful, but also educating and inspiring the visiting public.
Yeah. I believe you mentioned New Guinea impatiens.
Yes.
How are they different from regular impatiens?
Yeah, you know, New Guinea impatiens for us, the reason we're doing this collection and actually leaning on them more is standard impatiens for a good portion of the eastern United States and Wisconsin. This impatiens downy mildew has ravaged standard impatiens, and it's a very quick death for those. And in past years, we used to install 40 to 50,000 standard impatiens. And once the mildew sort of caught up to us, we're leaning on New Guinea impatiens simply because they're this species, and many are hybrids, but in essence, they're resistant to the same mildew issue.
Okay.
So as a shade-tolerant annual with a lot of color, they're offering that oomph. And we don't actually use standard impatiens anymore. We're leaning on the New Guineas, which tend to be a little shorter. There are some bigger ones now, but what our display will encompass this year are all the seed-grown varieties that are still out there.
What can we expect to see in the way of shrubs? Anything new this year at the garden?
Well, every year we're installing not only new annuals and perennials, but our woody plant collection. We have about 1,000 varieties of trees and shrubs. We're looking at all sorts of newfangled shrubs. And I have to say, my focus with our limited acreage, we only have 20 acres, which seems like a lot, but we're very heavily planted. We're focusing on very unique shrubs that either have multiple seasons of interest, you know, for instance, beautiful spring flowers, a nice fall color, maybe some interesting winter form, but those that fit well in compositions, not just shrub borders, but we're putting them in with perennials and inserting them throughout our compositions.
It sounds wonderful. Well, we have many callers online to visit with you, so let's go to the phones. Kathy and Madison up first. Kathy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, thanks for taking my call. I just was wondering if it is too late to do rejuvenation pruning of lilacs and such. It's been a strange winter, you know.
Yeah.
It's absolutely not. It's not too late to do that rejuvenation. I think you're aware that everything you remove, obviously, we're taking the flowers with them. The standard pruning of a lilac would be after they bloom, so, you know, roughly a year ago. However, that rejuvenation of taking out larger trunks or canes can be done at any point now. And what you'll do is you'll encourage some new growth this year that'll then bloom next year. So your timing's still solid.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
And you're going to knock those right down to the base.
You bet. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Arlene in New Berlin then. Hi, Arlene.
Yeah. Good morning. Thank you, Larry. I totally enjoy your show. It's so informative.
Thank you.
The reason I'm calling is I would like to know, my living room faces the north side, and my bedrooms are on the west side. Yeah, I can't do a lot of gardening anymore like I want to. So I want to put, like, evergreens, the softer globe evergreens on both sides and kind of space them accordingly so I don't have a lot of needle drop, you know, which happens if you plant them too close together. And I wanted to know the softer kind of evergreen, genus would it be that would be easy to trim, you know, or
sure.
have somebody else do, so it keeps a global shape.
Sure.
But would protect the house against the wind. And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Well, there's actually a lot of options. You know, with the north side of the house, there's a couple of things to examine before you start planting, and that's the degree of shade. You know, is the shade offered by the house? Are there surrounding trees, root competition? The soil around the foundation of a home is frequently challenging as well. So keeping your selection happy is important, so knowing the site. I think when you mention the term globe and a little more feathery and soft, you're alluding to arborvitae. Which are Thuja, and that's Thuja. Arborvitae are quite shade tolerant. The challenge is if you're in a woodland situation or in any area with deer, they'll come right up to the house and nibble on those. So they tend to be a little tastier. If you don't have a deer problem, they would do okay. But you may want to examine, you know, yews have been planted forever around homes because they're extremely durable. You know, deer like nibbling on those as well. But one more consideration would be boxwoods. They're fairly slow growing. These are broadleaf evergreens. They're not actually a conifer, but they'll have a globular shape, and ultimately they're deer resistant, and in time they'll be a nice sphere, minimal leaf drop, and again you'll have a nice shaped shrub with many years of growth.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. And the name of the last one again?
Boxwood.
Boxwood, sure. Makes sense. Let's go to Jack in Rhinelander next. Hi, Jack.
Yes.
What can we do for you?
I have about a half-acre yard, and years ago, I can't, you know, I'm not precise, but probably 15 to 18 years ago, I ordered some shrubs out of a magazine, and you know, enough to cover the whole circumference of my backyard, which was, you know, well, like I said, about a half acre or so. And we planted them, like the direction said, but not one grew, not one. And I do not know why. My yard is, well, when we dug our basement, there was a lot of sand and a lot of clay. Otherwise than that, but around the whole yard, without nothing growing, I do not know what was wrong. I have a lot of popples, a lot of hardwoods, whatnot, but I could not get them to grow. I was wondering if you would have an idea why.
Do you remember what you planted?
No, I do not. But it was supposed to be zoned for number three, which is really cold weather.
Yeah.
I know.
Okay, so that's a tough one. Now, you're in the Rhineland area, so that it's not surprising that the where the basement was dug, there was sand involved, for sure, Mark.
Yeah, you know, the concern with the establishment of, my guess is, when you're getting a certain quantity, they're smaller specimens, and the establishment phase of these smaller specimens, regardless of what they are, and I will take a step back and say it's good you address the hardiness issue, because that would have been my first question. Were they hardy for your area? So it sounds like that was the case. But getting established can become a challenge because, again, knowing the needs of the plant is vital, not only the type of soil it prefers, the watering regime. Are there certain pests or problems that might adversely affect their establishment? So, again, it may have just been a case of bad luck. It's odd that all of them didn't do well, so I wonder if there's some other overriding challenge.
I wonder if there wasn't a rabbits or something, too, that chewed them off and in the winter or whatever, and they just didn't come back up.
That could be very well. It's tough to say not knowing what the plant is,
yeah.
But I hope that won't discourage you from trying something else. The danger, though, in a monoculture, let's say you had 40 or 50 of the same plant and we're laying it out to be sort of a pseudo-hedge, the danger is if something adverse is affecting these, it'll just go through that population. So
yeah.
Mixed borders are sometimes a better way to go.
And probably, would a soil test be in order? Even though we kind of know it's sandy, I think if you put a soil test and then specified what you were interested in planting, telling the people that, you could get some recommendations on some proper plants to put in.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that may help. Good luck, Jack. Thanks a lot for calling. Lots of different things could have happened there. You can join in, too, with your questions. We started talking about shrubs, but we're certainly taking questions in other areas as well with our guest, Mark Dwyer, from the Janesville, the Rotary Botanical Gardens. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Jeff in Superior, your turn now. Hi, Jeff.
Thank you. Good morning.
Morning.
Hey. About 100-some years ago, my great-grandmother immigrated from Sweden and had a farm in rural Douglas County. My grandfather then inherited the farm, and they stopped farming when Eisenhower was president. And it's his goal, when he was working for Burlington Northern Railroad, to let the land go back to nature. And he encouraged me to think of, you know, trees to plant on what used to be, you know, a hay field or where they grew potatoes and stuff like that. So I have a plan this spring to plant some birch trees. I got some yellow birch and some white birch, paper birch. And I want to know what's the best time in the spring to plant those trees.
Okay. Are you going to be, are these small trees, very small?
Yeah, like 2-3 feet tall.
Okay.
Things that I'm going to transplant, you know, from a pot.
Yeah.
And they'll have full sun. And
okay.
Yeah, you're heading into the best time. I mean, I'm speaking from further south, of course, but you know, your timing is coming up real nice here in April. And birches, okay, for us, the best time to transplant them is either before they leaf out, because my question would have been if they were bare root, if these were, you know, bundles of birches you were getting that were bare root, where you'd have to get them in the ground right away. But try to get them in before they leaf out, and if you don't have the time to do that and they're in containers, I would maintain them till late summer and then poke them in. There's a real danger in mid-spring through summer with establishment. So your timing, I think, would be April or later September.
Okay, because when I lived in northern Illinois, in Evanston, I planted birch trees, and boy, it was June, and they grew very nicely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So
I was wondering, no earlier than, you know, maybe definitely after Easter, maybe around the time my taxes are due.
Yeah, that should be about right, Jeff. I like how you think and use events to let us know what, you know, the Eisenhower administration and Easter and whatnot. So good for you and good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And birch are going to, I would think, do pretty well up in that area. Let's go to Dennis in Elizabeth, Illinois. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, how are you today?
Great, appreciate the call.
Yeah, so just a quick question. We've got about a 50-year-old peony here at the farm, and we had to move our house, so we're wanting to transplant that, and so I'm just wondering if this is a good time of year to do that, and then some tips on about how deep to dig and how far around the plant to dig to get that transplanted. And I'll just take my answer off the air.
All right.
Well, peonies, you're heading into the second best time to do it, and that's in the next couple of weeks as we head into April. They're starting to really bud out, and those buds will swell very shortly. So the challenge with peonies being so heavily rooted, when you're digging them, it's like digging a woody shrub. So you can't overdo it in terms of radius. Like, really work your way in from the outside. Get as much of the roots as you can. You'll get some exercise digging these things up. But my advice, if you're going to do it yet in the next couple of weeks, is to do it on a cloudy day. Plant it at the same level in its new location as quickly as you can. Water the heck out of it. It may not bloom. It may struggle a little bit, but it's very hard to kill a peony. Having said that, it's sometimes difficult to reestablish a transplant in the course of a year, so just be ready for it to recover. Another great time of year to do it is in very late summer, early fall, but it sounds like the timing with your move is going to necessitate a spring move with this peony. Just give it a good go and pamper it, and you'll be fine.
There we go. Thanks so much for calling. Mark Dwyer, Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your garden and your lawn area, your shrubs in the landscape with Mark Dwyer, Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens, Larry Mueller here. Join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. You can email us as well at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's turn to Cindy next from Baraboo. Hi, Cindy.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, we bought a house that we don't live in, but the grass on part of the lawn just will not take. It gets real. It looks like half a year like it does right now. It can get a little green, but it dies off really fast. So in the spring, it's late to turn green, and then in the summer, it just doesn't stay green. It'll get brown and dry off.
Sounds like zoysia grass.
What's that?
I said it sounds kind of like zoysia grass, which is
a type of grass.
Yeah, it's zoysia. It's often advertised in magazines and so forth, and it looks really good, but it's not a good grass for Wisconsin, generally speaking.
Well, we've planted other grass there. It just doesn't take.
Okay.
I was wondering if somebody had maybe, before we purchased the land, sprayed it with something. It's only on one side of the house, and you know, it sticks out like a sore thumb from the rest of the neighborhood.
Yeah, how shady is it?
It's not really shaded. Part of it is, part of it isn't.
Mark, what do you think?
It's a tough call, you know, again, not seeing the site. And to Larry's point, there are some grasses that aren't appropriate for our climate that tend to go dormant in midsummer and start to brown out. So if it's a good-sized patch and you continually have problems with it, that could lend itself to some sort of a soil issue or something underground that's challenging that grass. And I think that's certainly why Larry asked about shade, because frequently shallow-rooted trees can outcompete turf quite dramatically. So if you have a local extension agent, maybe take some photos of it as it declines or share that information, and I think you'll probably get some better advice as to what's happening.
You might try a soil test too. In that, I would test the soil there and say tell the soil testing people you're interested in grass there, and you may get some good advice from that.
Okay. All right. I will try that.
All right.
If you can help.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Sure does sound like zoysia grass, but
yeah.
We have one lawn in the neighborhood, in my neighborhood, where there was zoysia grass planted, and it looks terrible. In right when you want it looking great.
Well, I think bent grass will do that too. There's some bent grass in one of our lawns at the gardens, and if it's not irrigated, it turns brown late in summer. So yeah, it could be a species issue.
Let's go to Sue in Mequon next. Hi, Sue.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question specifically for me is about I want to transplant some sedum and pachysandra, but maybe you could talk about transplanting in general in the spring. My question is it more soil temperature? Is it more do I wait for some plant growth, or do I just do like most of my gardening, do it when I get to it?
Yeah.
Well, sometimes doing it when we can get to it seems to work out with our schedules. But, in terms of timing, we do the majority of our spring division is usually in later April and early May. That's in the southern portion of the state. And we're dividing things like sedum when we say spearing out of the ground. And we use this in reference to other perennials like hostas and others where the growth is less than an inch tall. And soil temperatures are still fairly cold and warming up. And the reason it's a great time to divide it is there's minimal disruption of the growth. And these plants are really none the wiser once you move them and they settle into their new location with warming soil, adequate moisture, etc. Pachysandra can be moved pretty much any time. Moisture is important with that. And in terms of dividing pachysandra, make sure you get a lot of root because there tends to be a lot of growth above the soil level. So the roots are going to be real important. and lots of water to establish it. But the majority, again, of our division is done in spring. But to your comment about, you know, as your schedule allows, the majority of plants can be divided just about any time, but their appearance and recovery later in the season is a little more apparent, a little more bedraggled with a summer division and move. So do it this spring if you can.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. And Susan in Bayfield, thank you for calling. Looking forward to visiting up there in Bayfield in early May. What's on your mind?
Hello. I am calling about honeyberries. We ordered some plants last year from a catalog, and they came bare root, and they didn't look really good. They looked kind of like dead sticks, but we planted them. We had, I think, four plants, and none of them survived. I contacted the company, and I questioned the health of what we had gotten, and they replaced them. They looked about the same. We planted them again, and again, they didn't survive. This year, we've ordered some from a different company, and I'm wondering if I'm doing something wrong or if I just didn't get really good plants that first time around.
Well, that's a great question. I have to admit I'm not that familiar with honeyberries, to be honest. We don't grow those at the gardens. It sounds like when you talked to the company, did they verify, are they hardy for your area?
They said that they were. The ones that I ordered for this year actually come from a farm in Minnesota, so I'm hoping that that's going to be closer.
Yeah, well, that should. Yeah. That honeyberries, I'm just looking here, they're non-invasive relatives of honeysuckle.
Yeah, Larry pulled up a nice site here describing it in a picture, which is neat. But I'm wary of giving you information because, again, with the establishment of any sort of new plant, it's making sure ultimately it has the right soil, and it sounds like you did everything right with the establishment phase. I just wonder again if it's an issue with the site. Is your intent to try them in a different location?
I can. The location that we put them in was basically full sun.
Yeah, sun and good soil.
Yeah, our soil does have quite a bit of clay.
Yeah, that might be a factor, and I guess I'm talking about a plant I'm not real familiar with, but again, a little more research on it might help with keeping it happy and healthy. It sounds like, in what we're looking at here, that they're hardy.
You need a well-drained soil, I'm reading.
Okay.
And that could be an issue with heavy clay, for sure.
Okay, so supplementing the soil before we put it in?
Yeah, pick maybe a better drained location and pamper. Maybe put some screening around them. I don't know if there's any predators or anything that might nibble on those plants. But it sounds like the ones you originally installed never did anything and just died, which is disconcerting to say the least. I have to admit, I'm always a little wary of the time in transit with some of these plants and if they dry out in shipment. So I think hydrating and maybe soaking them in water for 24 hours before planting them might help out as well and
that
get those roots established.
Yeah, that would be a big help.
Okay, that's a good idea.
All right, and then check that soil. You need a well-drained one. All right, thank you for calling, Susan. Let's turn to Maxine and Marinette next. Hi, Maxine.
Well, good morning. I love your program.
Thank you.
I am wondering if it is too late to trim the lower branches on my 10-year-old linden tree.
Not at all. Go for it. Your timing's still good. At the gardens in Janesville, we're still finishing up our winter pruning. And when you talk about architectural or structural pruning, whether it's limbing a tree up or thinning out crossing branches and such, in almost every case, the dormant season is preferable because you can kind of see what you're doing, get in there, and not disrupt any active growth. So your call is perfectly timed. I would do it as soon as you can in the coming weeks.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Thanks so much for calling. And you can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Let's turn to Karen in Edgerton next. Hi, Karen.
Well, good morning.
Morning.
I have a very old, large oak tree that's in tree dieback, and it has been a marvelous shade for my hosta gardens. And in anticipation of having to remove it in the next couple of years, I'm wondering if there's you could recommend some very fast-growing tree that could, provide shade for my hosta gardens.
Yeah.
Sure. It's always kind of a bummer to lose trees that size, of course, particularly an oak that's had a long history. But, you know, you have to balance your desire for quick growth with a tree that'll be appropriate for the site. And I know the shade will be important to maintain your garden and what's been there under that oak tree. Some of the fast-growing trees tend to be a little soft-wooded, and, you know, so things like silver maples I'm wary of because they grow extremely quickly but tend to have problems later in life. Honey locusts tend to shed branches and be a little challenging, and these are two trees that are very quick-growing and would be appropriate for that site. But again, the challenge is some of the things that happen as they grow quickly. What's exciting, though, is there are some excellent hybrid trees out there, and a lot of people are scared of elms, understandably because of Dutch elm disease, but there's absolutely beautiful hybrid elms right now that have been back-crossed with Asian counterparts. So in essence, they're resistant to Dutch elm disease, extremely fast-growing, have that nice vase-shaped look, and there's dozens of varieties now. And at Rotary Gardens, for larger shade trees, we're leaning on a lot of these hybrid elms simply because of their growth rate, being hard-wooded, and ultimately offering that nice cathedral-like space.
Sure. Is there a particular variety that species that you like better than others, or?
Well, there's a great series that came out of the Morton Arboretum, which is in the Chicago area, and I believe there's five elms in that series. And if you get online and Google up Morton Arboretum and elms, you'll find these different accolade is very common. That's one of the more common varieties. We have all five of them, and we've had these for many years, and they're beautiful. And their growth rate is 2 to 3 foot a year, which is exceptional. So look into it.
And one other thing that somebody else was telling me about that they did was to put up some screening. They put up some shade in the form of screens where they grew things on the, you know, peas or climbing plants. And, you know, if you could do that, you know, some sort of trellising or so forth situation, you might be able to shade those while the tree grows. I don't know. But I know one person had really good luck with that.
Okay. Thank you so very much.
Yeah, take a look at that as an idea. At least you'd have something to give you a little bit of help when that tree comes down.
Mm-hmm.
Judith in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Judith.
Hi. I would like to get some tips on digging out some Siberius iris that are in serious need of dividing. We've tried this for the last couple of years. I have some willing helpers, but they seem to be, like, impacted in the ground. And I'm wondering, do we soak this area overnight? Are there some secrets to digging out something that is so resistant?
Doesn't want to come out, huh?
No.
Well, in Siberian iris, over time, will create a really congested colony. So your timing is good for doing that. And with this congestion ultimately impacts flowering in time. And so division is warranted. And my advice to you would be the soaking might be necessary if we don't have a wet spring here. But you're heading into a period of time when you see that iris actively growing, starting to, I've used the term already in the show, and that's spearing out of the ground. When it's about an inch tall, do not bat an eye and get in there with sharp spades and just dice that thing up and be severe on it. And as you're bringing up chunks, start pulling them apart and dividing it. Discard anything that looks unsightly or seems to have an issue. But you'll have, I don't know if your intent is to share them or replant them or what have you, but you'll have more than enough to give away. But you should be extremely aggressive and with digging this up. Don't pamper it.
All right, so you're saying a sharp spade would be the best tool to be using versus, I don't know what else, because I think we've tried that, and maybe we're just not being aggressive enough. But the soaking is a good idea if we don't get enough rain?
That sure helps, and I'll back my comment up by saying something we find with ornamental grasses is when we're digging them up, if the congestion is so tight that you can't even get a spade in the center of that, dig the entire thing up from the edges, excavate it, which is will be like digging up a shrub, and sacrifice a hacksaw or some sort of a saw and actually, you know, put it on a tarp or the grass and saw it apart and divide it. If a spade's not, again, cutting it for you, literally and figuratively, excavate the entire thing and then butcher it.
Okay. Sounds good.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Are there spades out there that are really sharp to begin with?
There are, but I think you get what you pay for with tool quality.
Yeah.
But I think universally we don't keep our tools sharp enough.
Yeah.
And they need to be ready for spring.
Yeah. File them and sharpen them up
mm-hmm.
with a file. Let's go to Austin in Woodman. Hi, Austin.
Yeah, I had a question. I'm looking for ideas for ground cover for a couple of banks there on my property. I've got about as much time doing the weed trimming as I do in mowing these days, and I'd like to get something on those banks that would just kind of take care of that. I was thinking maybe like I looked at periwinkle or maybe some of the tiger lilies, but just didn't know for sure. Something that would spread quick. And
yeah. And you've got how big an area and what kind of a decline or how steep is it?
Oh, it's fairly steep. It'd be real hard to till. So I was hoping to do like 100% kill and then maybe find something that I could rake in or do okay. something to that effect. It's not that it's unwalkable, but it's not handy to try to till by any means.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, the challenge is, it sounds like your approach is good, killing off everything that's there and starting over. And, of course, erosion control is probably a concern and getting things growing quickly. You mentioned periwinkle or vinca. Likely that would grow and establish in time and create a nice network. You know, the issue with any sort of ground cover is the challenge of quick coverage, of course, and ultimately dealing with any organic debris that starts to infiltrate into that. The idea that if there's overhead trees and things like that, the cleanup ultimately is up to you, but the goal with any sort of ground cover in this situation is that it excludes any other weeds or anything infiltrating that solid mat. I know along highways, there's a lot of use of what's called crown vetch, which I would never recommend for garden use, but what it does is it quickly colonizes the slopes that you see at overpasses and exchanges where that's what it's doing is outcompeting some of those problems. And that's something you can seed in or find plants. I don't know what the square footage is, but I'd be wary of things like Pachysandra. English ivy is okay, but these are plants. Everything I've just recommended is something in a different context I would never recommend for garden use because they don't stop growing or spreading. But you need something aggressive.
Yeah. I wonder about, is there any chance prairie plants could work there?
Oh, depending on the site, I think if you did a matrix of mixed plantings instead of a monoculture, maybe that would work as well.
I'd be tempted to look online to a place like Prairie Nursery or just type in prairie plantings on slopes and just see what comes up. Just as another alternative.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I emailed the UW Extension, and that's been about a week ago, and I haven't heard a response from them yet, so kind of the exact same question. So that's what I was just wondering. I appreciate your help.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Good luck. Appreciate that call. And let's take another call, this one from Ryan in Madison. Ryan, hello.
Hi there. A couple calls back, you had a person looking for some shade where an oak was dying back for some plants, some ground plants that they had. I picked up a couple of willows down at K&W, and they were a hybrid vase-shaped. They don't grow more than, say, 15, 20 feet tall, and, you know, you can, just, because they're vase-shaped, you can mow under them, or you can get under there to tend to your plantings. But if you planted those on the north side of that, or on the south side of your plant, you'd get some shade.
Get some shade.
I was really impressed with the speed that they grow out and fill out.
Yeah, Yeah, they grow really fast, but then they die a little faster too, don't they? How long do those live, Mark? Do you know offhand?
Well, you know, you think about seeing weeping willows around our parks and such. Well, you'll get a good 40 or 50 years out of them. And I think to Ryan's comment, the hybrid willows would at least be an affordable, quick-growing, at least temporary screen.
Yeah.
Willows are all softwooded, so the danger with letting them get too big is they eventually start to have issues. But their growth rate is exceptional, and that's really not a bad idea at all.
Yeah, good idea. Thanks, Ryan.
When you first plant them, you probably want to put a little fencing around them because the rabbits like them. After a couple of years, then they tend to leave alone.
All right, good advice. Thanks, Ryan.
Right.
Yeah, appreciate the call. We have Marla in Marquette County next. Hi, Marla. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Shrubs in shade. I live just about a half mile south of the Washera County line. I have a lot of sand. I have a lot of shade, a lot of pine. I've tried a few things so far. Viburnum seems to be the only thing I can grow. Any suggestions?
What grows well around viburnum, I guess, might be a question for you there, Mark.
Yeah, sandy shade can certainly be a challenge. You know, shade in and of itself starts to limit your selections. And viburnums are a good choice. There's a lot of great selections out there, although they're starting to have issues with root borer and a leaf beetle and some other problems.
That's one of the things I'm concerned about. I have so many viburnums. I don't want to wipe everything out like elms and other species, you know, if something happens.
Right, right. And if height's not a huge consideration, there's a lot of sumacs will take sand and also a little bit of shade. The issue with sumacs is they tend to colonize. And if that's not an issue where, you know, the roots are sending up new growth and creating a wider plant every year, look into some of the various sumacs. There's smooth sumac, staghorn sumac. Some of the there's some that get quite large, but they'll take some tough conditions.
The patch of sumac I have, the deer keep under control.
Oh, uh-huh. Sure. So you have the trifecta of sand, shade, and deer, so that's a real challenge.
Well, I planted a pussy willow and put a big cage around it. They just reached down and ate it.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not actually thinking of anything that's going to help you at this point. If you have some neighbors that have some success in those similar conditions, or again, maybe your local extension agent has something that could be recommended, but that's
or a dog that you could leave out at night.
Yeah, there's that. Oh boy,
there we go. Oh, thanks for calling, Marla. Appreciate it. Mark Dwyer, our guest, Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at shrubs and all kinds of other plants around the home today with our guest, Mark Dwyer, Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. I'm Larry Mueller. And we have open lines. You can get in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. We're going to take some email questions coming up right after we hear from Dave in Arcadia. Dave, thank you for waiting.
Oh, thanks, Larry. I have some hydrangeas that I'm going to be planting outside of my steps going down into the backyard. And I just wonder if there's going to be enough sun for them, because it's on the east side of the house. Now, I know that the soil needs to be acidic for hydrangeas, so I can take care of that problem, no problem. But I'm just wondering if they're going to get enough sun there, because usually by 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, it'll be a shaded area.
Okay.
Yeah, Dave, do you know offhand what type of hydrangeas they are?
I think they're the snowball variety.
Okay.
The big white ones.
Yep.
Yeah. Those are smooth hydrangeas, and that's more than enough light. They actually can take quite a bit of shade, so an east exposure is fine. That morning light is sufficient. My only warning, in the acidity certainly helps all hydrangeas to a certain degree, but ultimately, they tend to be quite thirsty, all hydrangeas. So the fact that they're close to the house, you'll be able to see them. But again, your lighting is fine. Just keep up with the watering because they'll dry out quicker than just about anything in the landscape.
Yeah, I've come up with some ideas for irrigation, so that shouldn't be a problem. And also, I would like to make a comment about transplanting some of the things that I've heard about transplanting today. And we have a heavy clay soil here, and we always have to find some topsoil somewhere and mix it with some sand and kind of mix them all together. And then I throw in some blood meal and some bone meal along with it, and I'll tell you, our peonies are just beautiful.
Yeah.
Also our irises. So that may help some of your listeners.
Yeah, that, good points. Thank you very much, Dave, for calling. Appreciate your call. Rich in Hudson emailed to ask if he can top his 24-foot-tall Black Hills spruce trees to 14 feet, or should he take them down and replace them with shorter species? They're shading the roof. He wants to put solar panels on. And I don't think he's going to be happy with the look after he would top, Mark.
No, you know, taking that much off, it's going to create a flat top that'll never truly recover. And visually, if that's okay with him, that's all right. But it that Christmas tree form will be lost. Taking off less, or in a windstorm on occasion, these evergreens, when they lose the central leader, they'll develop another leader in time. But if this were my situation at home, I would remove it and do something else.
Yeah. And Meg on Facebook wonders, when is the best time to remove a bridal wreath, or to move a bridal wreath spirea?
Yeah, actually let it bloom first. And so it'll be blooming here in early to mid-spring. And your move can either be done in right after flowering. Now, I will say, if it's getting hot already and wherever she's located, do wait until fall. So your best time is right after flowering, or do it in late September, early October.
Jim emailed to ask if burning bush is a good thing for a hedgerow. He likes the color, but he's heard they're invasive, and he's right about that.
Yes, burning bush is an excellent plant in many respects, but the issue, of course, is the fact that the seeds, the fruit, is being spread far and wide by birds, and that's what's colonizing the understory of a lot of our woodlands. So I think very shortly, burning bush won't be promoted in any way, shape, or form as a viable landscape plant because of that, but I know there's research into sterile varieties and those that aren't fruiting, so it's a good thought, but there's a lot of other things that would suit a hedgerow as well.
Yeah, and Bob in Madison called on Crown Vetch. You mentioned Crown Vetch, and it is an invasive plant. It's on the invasive plant list in Wisconsin, so it's not one they're recommending. So,
well, I appreciate Bob calling. I feel horrible for even mentioning it. Yeah, so let's forget I even said it.
When you mentioned it, I wasn't sure that it was on the invasive plant list. So. Mm-hmm. Let's go to Bill in Oregon next. Bill, hi. Thanks for calling. Bill, let's hold on a second. Let me put you on, see if I can get you on. Bill, are you there? There, no, I think we have you.
You got me?
Yep, got you
right
now.
Well, thanks for taking the call. I wanted to make a comment about the false sunflower. It makes a large ephemeral that can hit 5-6 feet. It's a good summer shrubbing kind of plant. You can build a temporary wall with it, and it grows in rock, sand, clay, and the deer leave it alone. I also had a question about, not related to shrubs, but I know that your expert has knowledge of this kind of stuff. I've been trying to grow an agapanthus in a 5-gallon pot, and I've learned that may be the reason it's never flowered is because it's got too much space. It fills a circle of about a foot across. Should I replant it into something that constricts the roots a bit more to try and get it to flower?
Yeah,
absolutely. You hit the nail on the head, because ultimately that congestion, that little bit of stress, ultimately leads to flowering. So by pampering it with extra soil, it's putting more growth into vegetative growth as opposed to flowering. So when we use we've used Agapanthus at the gardens, we get it in congested pots, very small pots where it's already starting to bloom, and we actually leave it in those pots and insert them into containers and out in the landscape because we want them to still have that level of congestion to continue prolonged bloom throughout the summer. So absolutely repot it in a tighter container.
Thanks a lot.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Dan in Superior next. Dan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. Say, I think I have a simple question. For a long time, I've left flowers and the seed heads of plants around my yard. Just leave them up through the winter in case any wildlife could make use of them. And every year at this time, I wonder about if there's a good way to help encourage spreading the various plants. Especially, I have a patch of echinacea that I'd like to see increase, but it usually seems to just stay about the same amount coming up every year. So I'm wondering how to go about, if putting the seeds down earlier, if they how to propagate that.
Yeah.
And
okay.
What time of the year is the best time of the year to do that?
Actually, you're heading into a great time of year to do that. And the fact that what you'll be doing, in essence, is just helping what Mother Nature has done for countless years, and that's facilitating seed dispersal. So with
sure.
The coneflowers, whatever the birds haven't picked off and such, you certainly can break those apart and spread them and lightly rake them in, even today if you wanted to. The challenge is there's still a lot of critters you'll lose a certain amount of seeds at ground level simply because of
right.
nibbling and such. But the seeds have already been stratified. They've gone through a winter, in essence, so they're primed and ready. So the thing about purple coneflowers, it's actually a fairly short-lived perennial. And ultimately, our best patches at Rotary Gardens, we let the seed fall back into the mama plant, so to speak. And what we're seeing over the course of many years isn't the original plant. It's the constant regeneration of new growth. So I think you have a great direction with getting these out there and spreading them and helping them colonize. And it's before long, you'll see babies, and you can thin the herd a little bit, move them around. But, yeah, do take the initiative to do that. I think you're right on track.
Okay. Well, I guess maybe it's been reseeding itself because they've been there for, like, a decade, but they really haven't increased in the amount. But I'll see if I can help them, and thanks for your help.
Yeah, thank you for calling, Dan. And Terry, what's on your mind in Rock Falls?
Hi, I've got a tough one for you.
Okay.
Thanks for taking my call here. Pleasure to talk to you. I have this hedge that we've had for maybe 30 years. It has small tube-shaped, kind of bell-shaped pink flowers, maybe a quarter inch. The bees love them. Small, oval-shaped leaves that are slightly pointed, and it's like a multi-stemmed hedge kind of thing. And we got it from a catalog many years ago, and I can't find it anymore. So I've looked at all kinds of identification, et cetera, and I was hoping maybe you might know what it is.
What size? Do you keep it at a certain height, or have you seen what's its mature size?
It is probably 6-8 feet tall. No, I don't prune it at all. It's just I just let it go.
Yeah, but my guess is that it's some sort of a honeysuckle.
It's not a honeysuckle.
Huh? Okay.
It's not that. I can swear to that. It gets blackberries on it actually. And it's not a buckthorn because I think buckthorns have single seeds in the berries and this has double seeds or vice versa.
Hmm. Boy, I wonder if you're able to send a picture to Larry, we could probably take a look at it. If you have any...
Yeah, unfortunately, it's just sticks right now.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I would offer, feel free to send it to my email at Rotary Gardens if you get on our website. If you as you go through the season... ultimately, I'm real curious as to what that is, but without seeing the flowers specifically, that's a tough guess.
I know. I appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
That I'm handing you a conundrum here.
Well, take
all right, I'll wait till it flowers.
Yeah, wait till it flowers. Get some shots of the close-ups of the flowers and the leaves, and then maybe a little longer shot, too, or further back. Mark could get, some different looks at it. Yeah, good luck. Thank you, Terry. And Joan in Madison, hi.
Yes, hello.
What can we do for you?
Oh, I'm hoping you'll be able to help me find a sunflower. I've seen these. The mammoth is not the mammoth, but I've seen these sunflowers. They're huge, and they have these great big flower heads with big leaves. What kind of sunflower is that, and where can I find the seed? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Well, there's a lot of giant sunflowers, and you mentioned you don't think it's giant mammoth, but a variety we've grown for fun because the kids enjoy going through it. A couple of years ago, we planted a variety called Kong, as in King Kong, K-O-N-G. It had massive leaves, huge flowers. It ended up getting 14 to 15 feet tall. So Kong, I know, is a massive variety, but there's a good dozen selections out there, and my guess is your local garden centers will all have seeds out at this point, or will very shortly, and you're likely to find some of those larger sunflowers, and they'll have pictures on the packet, so you should be able to identify something you're interested in.
I like those Kong. Our guest today is Mark Dwyer. Mark is Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens. He has degrees in landscape architecture and urban forestry. The Rotary Garden, a fun place to visit. Here on Garden Talk, I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest today, Mark Dwyer, Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens. Great to have him back, and this has been a lot of fun. Mark's having fun, and I am as well, as we talk with you about what's going on with shrubs and other plants in your lawn and garden area. You can join in. I think, there's an open line at 1-800-642-1234. And before we go back to our emails and our Facebook and our calls, Mark, I want you to tell us about the new wellness garden that you're putting in this year at Janesville Rotary Garden.
Oh, I'd love to share that. Keeping in mind our 20 acres is actually 26 different garden themes, and the newest theme, our arboretum, is being converted into a wellness garden, which features all accessible paths, raised beds. The construction is ongoing this spring, but it'll be folks can visit it, but heavy on sensory plants this year. Mm. And the intent is to engage all our visitors, but also use this garden for specific programming for mobility-impaired, cognitive-impaired guests and visitors. So it's going to be an exciting addition to our gardens.
Oh, that is wonderful news. Wellness garden at the Rotary Gardens in Janesville. Well, we have Janelle in Hilbert with a question for you. So let's go there. Hi, Janelle.
Hi, I have a recommendation for you. When you're splitting your plants, a cheap option is to go to your thrift store and get a serrated bread knife.
Ah, yeah, more than one, actually.
Yeah, you don't want to sacrifice a chainsaw with some of these things. And the serrated bread knives are excellent because we use those in fall to cut back our hostas. They work wonderfully. So it's actually a garden tool that everyone should have. So to Janelle's comment, and they're affordable, of course.
And, you may have to ask for them. Sometimes the thrift stores keep them in the back for safety reasons.
Ah, okay. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Thank you. That's a good idea. Mm-hmm. I'm going to pick one of those up at a dollar store or something and see what's out there. Let's go to Sue in Appleton next. Sue, hi.
Hi, Larry. Good show today.
Thank you.
I'm wondering about Ribes odoratum. I'm wondering what the source could be for it. I'm having trouble finding them. And also, what are the optimal growing conditions?
And what plant is... is there a common name for that plant, Mark?
Yeah, that's clove currant.
Mm-hmm.
And so Ribes odoratum, in terms of knowing a source, it's likely mail order because I've rarely seen him at nurseries. So if you were to get online, you'd likely find a source and get a little stick sent in the mail or something. But oddly enough, on the UW-Madison campus in the Botany Garden, there's a massive specimen. And if people have not experienced the scent of clove currant, it is unbelievable. And when this blooms, it's around the time of forsythias. It's covered with yellow blooms, extremely fragrant. Optimum growing conditions is full sun to part sun, well-drained soils. And, you know, very often with our plants, we hear moist but well-drained. That's exactly what you need with this plant. And extremely hardy, but again, a source, offhand, I wouldn't know.
Funny that there aren't more sources for that.
Right. You would, you know, I think for those that appreciate the scent, it's worth its space. Ornamentally, once it's done blooming, it's a green arcing shrub that takes up space. And but it, I think it's ornamental. We have one at the gardens as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mark.
Now, you're welcome.
Thanks for calling. And on to Jay in Portage. Hi, Jay.
Hi. Hey, I have a question about my hydrangeas. They're the same type that the other caller talked about, the big snowballs.
Yep.
And they've gotten really thick. They're on the north side of my house. They've been there quite a few years, and I usually cut them off. There's all the blooms from last year yet are on them yet. And I usually cut them off about a foot, foot and a half up. I'm wondering if I took like a sickle and just cut them all down to the ground, would they come back?
The short answer is absolutely. And some of Larry's listeners might be mortified to hear this, but with those smooth hydrangeas, as we speak right now, every patch of those at Rotary Gardens is about an inch tall. We've cut them all back.
We
cut them back every year because they'll bloom on new growth. And what's nice is you'll get a quick regeneration this spring. You'll have all new growth. It's very hard to kill those, so don't bat an eye when you're cutting those back.
Do you cut them back in the fall or in the spring?
We actually cut them back in fall only because we lack a lot of time for spring cleanup. So ultimately, you can do it any time from really November through March in the southern portion of the state.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. And on to Ken in Wausau. Hi, Ken. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I live in the city of Wausau, and we have a tremendous infestation of deer. So I was wanting to know, do you have any recommendations for deer-resistant type shrubs that will grow on a lighter soil?
Yeah, the deer-resistant comment is, I'm always wary of recommending plants. I think we all know there's no such thing really as deer-proof, because once they get hungry, they'll nibble on just about everything. But if I could cross-reference an email comment, a Facebook comment to Larry, there was a Sue who called recommending bottle brush buckeye for sandy soil. Bottle brush buckeye gets pretty big, 8 to 12 feet, and colonizes, but that would be deer-resistant. It does take up a lot of space, but you're very limited with the sandy soil comment. And to an earlier caller, there was a shady, sandy site with deer. I did allude to boxwood earlier. Now, boxwood is not hardy through the northern part of the state or in the coldest portions of our state, but ultimately, boxwood is extremely deer-resistant and can take sand if it's given proper establishment and a little bit of additional water. So it's an uphill battle with your conditions, but hopefully some of those ideas will help out.
Yeah, my experience with boxwood is that if you don't cover them in the winter, they freeze, they burn from the frost or the sun really easily.
Yeah, as a broadleaf evergreen, that boxwood can be challenging. I will say we're using a selection called Green Velvet. And again, this is the southern portion of the state, but we've seen almost no winter burning. Some of the older Korean-type boxwoods will get burned every winter regardless. So I think Green Velvet's a selection that folks may want to seek out and try.
Okay, and the buckeye, it's not like the buckthorn that spreads. I just cleared out.
No.
And it's not a buckthorn. So
yeah, this is the bottle brush buckeye.
Right. Bottle brush buckeye colonizes, but it is not a reseeder like you see with buckthorn. So you'll get a colonizing plant, beautiful white blooms in late spring to early summer. And, you know, look it up on the internet. They're gorgeous. We have a nice colony on actually a sandy slope at Rotary Gardens that's doing well.
Good. Thank you very much for those suggestions.
Yeah, thank you for calling. And Mark in Wometco? Is that correct?
No. It should have been Suamico.
Oh, Suamico. Okay, I know Suamico.
By the way, actually, we live right out by the new zoo in that area.
Okay. So sure. What can we do for you?
Well, good afternoon, fellas. We have a lake lot, it would be east of Rhinelander, and it's wooded. We're trying to create some kind of like a natural fence between us and our neighbors just to get a little privacy.
Yep.
So we're looking for, you know, it could grow as high as it would like, but something that adds, you know, thickness and privacy, I guess, is what we're looking for.
Well, I think as you go further north, taking some hints and clues from what's growing up that ways, and if height's not a restriction, you know, if your intent isn't doing, a formal row, maybe it's a mixed border of sorts, but you probably see a lot of white pines up that way, I would imagine.
Yes, yep, white pine, that's cedar as well.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, being anxious, we wanted to grow it faster, you know, so that it builds that fence sooner than later. You know, listening to earlier callers, this bottle brush buckeye, would something like that grow in that area?
Oh, I would think so. Offhand, I'm trying to remember the hardiness, but I think it would be hardy
that's
enough in that area. Three? Yeah.
You're at three, aren't you?
I would say at least, yes.
Yeah. I would check on that just to make sure, but you know, the idea of actually young white pines, I don't want to necessarily keep revisiting the pine thing, but they grow extremely quickly. So you'll see 2 foot of growth a year on those. So, you know, maybe you start some of those as part of a mixed border that'll ultimately fill in and offer some of the girth and screening, but you do something temporary or, additional with these shrubs. So, you know, the width of the screening, a lot of folks will plant a single row of something and wait for it to fill in. I encourage a thicker row of staggered shrubs and woody plants that'll offer collectively that screening and ultimately fill in even quicker.
Yes. Yeah, I think that would look more natural as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
Right.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you, guys. Have a good weekend.
Yeah, you as well. Thanks, Mark. And you can join in, too. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Let's turn to Lester in Racine next. Hi, Lester.
Well, hi, guys. How are you today?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Hey. Good. Hey, listen, I got a question about a balsam poplar that I planted about 4 years ago. It's getting real mature, and the suckers are coming up all around the base of it, and I've never transplanted the suckers, and they're about 3 feet tall, and I was just kind of wondering what the best way to do that.
Yeah, the thing about poplars is they'll colonize vast acreage ultimately and take up a lot of space, but all your suckers are connected to some sort of the root system. The challenge is the timing, and I think, again, spring is a good time to get in there, and you're really not going to hurt that plant by carving in there and trying to dig something up, but you'll want to get as much of the root as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately relocate that, water the heck out of it, and it should be okay, but I would encourage you to do it before it leaves out and target that. But, again, I think the timing is coming up very quickly.
Yeah, that's a balsam poplar. That's also called a balm of Gilead.
Mm-hmm.
So is that the same thing then, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, well, that's what I'll do. Thanks a lot.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. And let's see, we've got Bob and Kiwani up next. Hi, Bob.
Yeah, good afternoon. I was wondering, is there any variety of rhododendron or azalea or something in that family that would be winter hardy for this area in Kiwani? I'm close to Lake Michigan, so it gets very breezy here in the wintertime.
Yeah.
But we should be a zone 5.
Yeah, your zone is actually perfect for a wide range of rhododendrons and azaleas. The real challenge, and I'll use Rotary Gardens as an example, is we don't have very many nice-looking specimens because what we're lacking is acidity. Acidity in the soil helps, whether it's naturally there or you're augmenting. Really good soils that are well-drained also help out as well. So if you have those conditions, there's some great rhododendrons. I would, you know, old school, going back 30, 40 years, the PJM rhododendrons do real well for us. And they're commonly available. But I think even more exciting, there's these Finnish hybrids or Helsinki hybrids.
Okay.
And if you were to get online, and I can't remember the names of these offhand, but it's a series. There's a different colors, different varieties. They've done extremely well for us. And again, we have some challenging conditions.
Would that be readily available, do you think, from some of the bigger, well, not the box stores. Everything I get from the box stores, I've tried planting, and they just don't make it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Bob, you bring up a good point. You know, patronizing our local garden centers is super important, no doubt about it. And they would have the expertise to guide you towards these plants. Again, the challenge we find with rhododendrons and azaleas is knowing what they need before installation, because proper installation in the drainage in the soil and the pH is vital. But your hardiness is not a challenge, and there's dozens of varieties you could grow successfully with a little pampering.
Okay, one more question. Do they need protection from the winter winds? I'm close to Lake Michigan, and it's fairly open around me, and it roars through here in the wintertime, from no matter what direction the wind blows.
It sure doesn't hurt. And, you know, something we've done with our larger rhododendrons in our Japanese garden is every year we pound a couple metal stakes around them, and we put a burlap screen around the periphery up to the height of the plant. We're not covering the top. There's still air circulation in there, but even a single or a double layer of burlap encircling the plant mitigates and buffers those winds successfully, because the danger is in desiccation of those leaves and damage to those buds in when you have that spring bounce between a 60-degree day and the next day it's, you know, 30 degrees and there's heavy winds.
Right.
Yeah, so again, single layer or some sort of screening absolutely helps buffet those winds.
Well, excellent. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. Let's go to Bill in Deerfield now. Bill, hello.
Hi. Is it too late to prune oaks?
Yeah, the oaks, the challenge with oaks, the short answer is no. You want to prune them before they start leafing out actively. And one of the reasons that's encouraged is simply because pruning during the growing season, open wounds on oaks, and sometimes we have to prune them due to structural issues or wind damage or something like that. But fresh cuts during the growing season can help attract a beetle that spreads oak wilt, in essence. Oak wilt being spread by beetle vectors, beetles flying around between oaks or root grafts, and I'm going on a tangent here, but the short answer is you still have a window.
But not very long.
Not very long at all.
We're talking about a week or so.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if they start to leaf out, it's too late.
Yeah.
It's never too late, but you increase the risk of this oak wilt issue with fresh cuts during the leaf out. So try to do it in the next couple of weeks before they do much.
Tomorrow.
Yeah. Tomorrow would be good.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. So Dick called to let listeners know that UW Richland Center has a garden expo going on tomorrow. It's the fifth annual, and there are lots of things going on. There's a student things going on right at the center, at the student center. They'll be talking about vegetable gardening, small fruit growing, monarch butterflies, straw bale gardening. Cost at the door $12, but there's a lot there. And if you go to the UW Richland Center website, you're going to be able to learn all about it. And it is tomorrow, going on tomorrow. Jean emailed to ask, how can she green up her boxwood? Hers has lost its color.
Well, the question would be, if it's lost its color over the winter, if she's seeing a lot of browning, just simply leave it alone and see how it refoliates. We were talking earlier about some winter damage and some desiccation of leaves. There's very little you can do to green up a boxwood, short of, again, seeing where new growth starts to fill in, maybe a little bit of trimming. They're very responsive to trimming. But if it's a selection that continually has a loss of winter coloration, losing that deep green color, I would encourage her to examine that green velvet or some of the hardier hybrids that are out there.
And Gary called to just as a mention to the listener about shade trees. If you plant an elm, make sure you research the species, because some really shed. And there's some truth to that.
Yeah, elms as a category tend to shed a lot of smaller branches. And there are a lot of different hybrids out there. And again, these Morton Arboretum hybrids I mentioned earlier are pretty solid. I think we know slippery elms, Siberian elms, they are messy, messy trees. And but these are more characteristic of what we remember from American elms,
yeah,
that being some of their parentage.
They look a lot more like the American elm.
Correct, yeah.
And they can get about as big, can't they?
Yes, yeah, enormous.
Tom in Menominee Falls, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how you doing? I appreciate your show, and thank you very much.
Sure.
I have a question. I have a silver maple in my front yard, and I like to trim it drastically. It was never trimmed properly when it was quite small. What's the chance of that thing dying?
Great question. I'm comfortable saying the chance of it dying is probably nil, because what you'll see with silver maple, it being soft wooded, as you get in there and start pruning and removing branches, it's likely the sap flow is occurring. So you'll see a lot of the bleeding, and don't let that scare you off. Do what you need to do. But silver maples will respond very quickly with growth. You'll see it rebound very quickly. So again, I wouldn't worry about hurting that tree at all.
Okay, thank you much. Have a great day.
Thanks much for calling. Appreciate your call. And more callers, John in Shell Lake. Thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi there. I've got a question. I've got in my backyard, I've got about 10 or 12 very large oak trees, and I don't know what kind of oaks they are. But last summer, early on in the leafing season, the very ends of all the leaves, most of the leaves, especially the lower ones, got brown and just kind of crinkly. Two-thirds of the leaves look fine. I don't know what it was, and I'm hoping I'm not in danger of losing any of my trees.
What are the leaves like, by the way, just as an aside? Are they pointed? Are they sharp pointed, or are they rounded?
They're more rounded.
All right, so it's either a white oak or a bur oak, probably.
Yeah, well, and you know, it could have been a leaf anthracnose or some sort of another fungal issue. Last year, statewide, it was uncharacteristically cool and extremely wet, so we saw a lot more foliar issues with just about every woody plant we had out in the gardens due to that. So I think if we have an average year and have a decent summer with some heat and dryness, hopefully not drought, I guess I wouldn't worry so much about it. If the symptoms reappear on your new growth this year, get a diagnostic very quickly on what's happening, and you should get some guidance on what it is and what you may need to do to help those trees out.
Sometimes you can, if you take some good photos, you can send them to the insect diagnostic lab, and they can take a look at them there just online, and some oftentimes give you a pretty good guess as to what it is without even seeing the leaves, for example, in person.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, if you just Google that, it's going to come up and you're going to be able to send them some photos.
Okay, excellent. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Brian Huddleston, Dr. Death. We'll take a look. Well, what have you got coming up for events in the last 30 seconds or so we've got?
Sure. Well, we encourage people to see our spring garden. We're at the start of about 400,000 bulbs starting to bloom. And as we head towards Mother's Day, we have our spring plant sale. Everything's on our website. We sell heirloom vegetables, perennials, woody plants. It's a fundraiser for the gardens. And our calendar of events is online. Lots of fun things happening. The new garden spaces, new color themes. And if you haven't been to the gardens or haven't been recently, do come down and see what we're doing.
Oh, and it's right. It's nice. It's right off the interstate. It's a quick in and easy to get to, and it's always a lot of fun. Mark, thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry.
Look forward to your next visit.
Likewise.
Mark Dwyer, Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. They're right off the interstate, and boy, if you haven't been there, or even if you have, you better get back and take a look. Next week on Garden Talk, we have a couple of authors talking about their gardening books. On Monday, we'll take a look at what's going on at the Wisconsin Energy Institute and check with our weather guys. Stay with us. Lots in store.